we wanted to measure how the human MS brain at that stage of disease responds, if it does, to the transplantation of live, viable, and potentially therapeutic neural stem cells by comparing time zero with time 12 months.
I'm having chills. This is such impressive work. Well, hey, everyone. Welcome again to the Empowering Neurologist. You know, one question I am very frequently asked, especially in dealing with patients and families with neurodegenerative conditions, is where can we go for stem cell therapy? And is it effective for the particular problem, whether it's multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, you name it? People are exploring going to various clinics and getting stem cell therapy. And you know, my answer is, well, what does the science show? Is there any good science that indicates that there's validity to doing this type of therapy? And what exactly are they planning to do? And that said, how exciting that a recent study was just published that demonstrated interesting findings, I think very positive findings as it relates to treating a very progressive form of multiple sclerosis using stem cell therapy. And this was done in Cambridge. So I reached out to the lead researcher to find out more about their research and about these findings in particular. His name is Dr. Stefano Plucchino, and let me tell you a little bit more about him. Dr. Stefano Plucchino received his MD and his PhD at the University of Siena, Italy, and additional training at Cambridge University in the United Kingdom. He is currently professor of regenerative neuroimmunology and honorary consultant in neurology within the Department of Clinical Neurosciences at Cambridge University. I'm very excited about this podcast today. It is a bit science-y, where we really get into the weeds, so let's just get right to it. Dr. Plucchino, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, David, for having me.
We've got a lot to cover. Your work is, dare I say, groundbreaking and really very, very important for reasons, at least for me, that I explained in the introduction. So I want to walk our viewers through a very basic intro to what stem cell therapy is, and then we'll apply that knowledge to the treatment of the most found in your study, multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, the excitement is very much dependent on the initial promise that stem cell have been holding for many, many years without knowing a predominant mode of action, in addition to what we know now about stem cell therapeutics. So initially, the whole field was extremely excited of using stem cells, you know, like the Prometheus hope of regenerating entire piece of tissues after damage without interfering much with the pathobiology of a given disease, but with the realistic opportunity to recreate what's being damaged by either a sporadic event like a traumatic injury or a much more complex disease context, which is actually in part still applicable to specific applications in medicine, generally for very simple systems like the muscle or the skin or the cartilage or the bone. But the brain is way more complex than the skin. It's still an epithelium, but very complex in terms of ability to react to external perturbation, to diet, to physiological aging. So when applying stem cell medicine or stem cell therapeutics to the brain, then it becomes very complex, not only to understand what happens, but also to predict which is going to be the predominant or more or preferred mode of action to promote restoration of lost function. Because that's the expectation. When stem cells were introduced into experimental medicine, everyone in the field was expecting that with stem cells we would have been able to restore lost functions in a way that possibly was way more efficacious than any other biologic or small molecule or medication. So that's the ground stage.
So does the complexity of the brain throw you off base a little bit? I mean, we can understand how stem cells might help with muscle, even in the heart, and other, dare I say, unfortunately, more simple tissues. But the complexity of the brain in terms of its wiring and networks, et cetera, does that tend to want to dissuade you from the efficacy of using stem cell therapy?
But to be honest with you, I've been incredibly lucky in my scientific career. Because when you start with an experiment, of course you formulate an hypothesis, but you know already that there is a concrete chance that you will fail. I was lucky because the first experiment that we did, which was already 23 years ago, was a fantastic success. So we leveraged upon that initial success to move forward to develop a more ambitious project, which started from small laboratory animals, then it evolved towards larger non-human primates, and which culminated last month with the completion of a phase one, first-in-man, proof of concept human study. But the reason why we never gave up was, I think, possibly due to the fact that the first experiment did work. If that initial experiment would have not worked, maybe it would have changed our mind. And I'm being very honest with you, because basically the disease we decided to target back in the days is, in my view, and I'm a clinically active neurologist, so I have a daily contact with patients, it is, in my view, the least likely disease to approach with a non-hematopoietic stem cell medicine. It is a disease which starts, the disease is multiple sclerosis. This is a disease which starts usually from multiple genetic factors. There is predisposition factors to MS, but whenever it becomes clinically evident, it is accepted that MS comes from a disruption of our normal immune tolerance towards antigens or proteins specific of the central nervous system. So it is initially immune-driven, then it becomes inflammatory in an antigen-specific fashion, and then it becomes later progressive and degenerative in a non-antigen-specific fashion. So very complex, very heterogeneous, very different from individual to individual, and very different across different ages of life. So it is, by definition, something that you never start to approach applying an advanced cell therapy, which at least at the beginning was expected to promote remyelination. We have to be honest, at the beginning, stem cell therapeutics were developed in MS to promote remyelination because there is strong belief that the more remyelination we are able to promote in the brain, the slower is the progression of the disease and the lower is the chance for patients with MS to accumulate this irreversible disability. And we didn't succeed in full with the remyelination thing, but we were remarkably excited completely astonished by all the other findings that I can elaborate
Looking at your various studies, it seems to me that there's more going on than just the fact that remyelinization may or may not be occurring and that this is a demyelinative situation. It seems to me that you've gone upstream of that and you've gone to more of the immunological antigen-based issues that are involved in this disease. And for our viewers, classically, MS is described as being a demyelinative disease. In other words, the myelin protective coating over the individual neurons is getting digested away, it is thought, by an misdirected immune process. And all the therapies pretty much to date have targeted either that process or the inflammation that's accompanying it in an attempt to slow the situation down. And so what we're talking about now is, I think, really getting upstream of all that and asking the question through your research, well, why in the heck is this happening? And if it is, what can we do upstream to help slow this down? So the type of MS patients that you selected for your research were pretty specific in terms of the type of MS that they had. Tell us what that MS classification was, and then, if you could, explain why you chose that group.
Yeah, I think the choice of the patients participating to the phase one study is kind of obligation. When you develop an experimental medicine from scratch for the initial discovery to the translation to the clinic, and the disease you're going to target as the possibility to be treated or mitigated by a number of what we call disease-modifying therapies, which are available either on the NHS or through clinical trials, there is also ethical reasons by which major regulatory bodies suggest you to select those patients who are not eligible for any of the gold standards of care available on the NHS. So that's one reason. And the second is also the intrinsic risk of an experimental therapy that is it is run through a phase one trial. A phase one trial is the first step. It is the first mandatory step of a clinical experimentation. And the way phase one studies are designed implies that it is very difficult to extrapolate any means of efficacy. Rather, what is very important is that the trial is designed in a way which will allow investigators to establish in full whether that specific treatment is feasible, because there is a very important part of production and manufacturing and quality control. So whether it is feasible, whether it is completely safe, and whether it is well tolerated by patients. For these reasons, in the absence of a control group or a placebo-treated group of individuals, phase one trials are usually conducted either in healthy volunteers or in people with a disease which is such advanced which cannot be eligible for any other medication, which is why we selected individuals, total of 15 individuals, even though we started from over 180 patients volunteering for the trial. So it was very, very intense selection of people. Total of 15 individuals with advanced, fully established secondary progressive MS, including both active and non-active disease states. Secondary progressive MS is an inevitable evolution of the most typical form of MS, which is called relapsing remitting MS. And it is a clinical unmet need in the whole MS community. So even though we have more than 20 fully approved biologics, including small molecules, monoclonal antibodies, which are incredibly efficacious in reducing the impact of antigen-specific, usually it is T-cell-mediated inflammation, in relapsing remitting MS, 80% of people who are treated with disease modifying therapies during the relapsing remitting phase, inevitably, within 20 to 25 years from disease onset, become secondary progressive. And they don't have any medication available which works same way as the classical DMTs for relapsing remitting. So the secondary progressive MS is a major clinical unmet need. It is a great priority for major MS societies and funding bodies. Everyone in the world is working to understand not only why DMTs fail to delay the transition to secondary progressive MS, but also which are the mechanisms behind progression. And therefore, advanced cell therapeutics might be an option to interfere with progression, to slow down accumulation of neurological deficits, and to ameliorate secondary progressive MS. So that's the reason why we selected those patients.
So you had, I believe, 6 males and 9 females, which kind of speaks to the notion that, by and large, more women get MS than do males. But that said, you felt a sense of obligation that these people are really going downhill quickly, and we've got to do something. Do you think, and we're going to talk about your results in just a moment, because I think they're really quite dramatic, but do you suspect, this would probably be at the end of the interview, but anyway, do you suspect that you might be able to ultimately generalize the results in terms of a therapeutic intervention to the broader secondary MS population?
But in principle, yes, because we are coming, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, we are coming from more than 20 years of very extensive preclinical work, where the very same technology, which is once again, advanced cell therapy made of tissue-specific brain stem cells, was tested very pedantically in a number of animal disease or lesion-like models, including chronic forms of MS-like disease, including relapsing remitting forms of MS-like disease, including very acute, highly rapidly evolving MS-like disease in non-human primates. So in theory, looking at the biology of the cells that we have injected, in theory, there is very much room to apply in future these ACT, advanced cell therapy, also to non-progressive cases of MS. But we have to be realistic, and we have to face against the reality that we have lots of very druggable, very, very established DMTs for relapsing remitting MS, which are having a fantastic effect. So in terms of competition and discussion of whether we have to favor brain stem cells rather than monoclonals, rather than small biologics, I think that's a much more complex to understand in a conversation like the one we are having today. Looking at biology, I would say yes, loud, but we have to be realistic. And I think that the space for patients is for people with progressive MS at the moment.
So there's a couple of slides I'd like to go through that I think will help our viewers understand exactly what you're doing. But I wanted to start with this. This is a picture I took from your website. And this is a group of very, very happy people. And that sort of says a lot about everything that you do. What's going on in this photograph?
But it is inevitable. I mean, the thing is the following, that science is a fantastic job. I think it's the best job available on the market because it is intellectually free. We, of course, rely very much on fundraising, on successful paper submission and grant application. But intellectually, it's the best job I think I could ever had the opportunity to choose. And I have the privilege to work with very enthusiastic and young people who are striving to make a good progress towards their career. And the reason why everyone is happy in the picture is because we are a real family. As a matter of fact, if you have been following our website on social media like Twitter, you can see that we have a very frequent hashtag which comes with every post coming from the lab, which is hashtag we are family. Because that's the way we live every day in the lab. We spend the great majority of our daily time together in the lab, and we share successes, but very much, possibly much more frequently, unsuccesses, rejections, and arguments with the community and with peers. But in the end, we share curiosity, enthusiasm, and honesty, and that's pretty much why everyone is happy in the picture, because we are really happy.
This is genuine happiness here. And, this is a lab based on what I'm seeing in this more than anything else. This is a lab that's going to, really achieve wonderful things. So here we are. We're going to start talking about your study design and the group of patients that you chose. So let's work our way from left to right, across the top and then across the bottom.
Yeah. First thing that I would like to mention is the timing of the study. This is a study which started summer 2017, advertising the recruitment, and it was conducted almost entirely during the pandemic. So, and it was conducted by an international team of investigators, which was split between two patient recruitment sites, both of which were based in Italy, one central hub for advanced MRI analysis, which was based in Switzerland. And it was a fantastic effort, especially in coincidence with the pandemic. So just imagine that people had to travel to one of the two centers in Italy to be injected with the cells. They had to undergo lots of clinical, radiological, psychological assessments. When we will come back to the second part of the slide, you will see how supportive the patients and their families were. And these are individuals with a mean EDSS, which is a scale with which we measure disability, of 7.6 over a total of 10. Mm-hmm. 10 is a moribund patient.
What does that mean? If they're at a 7.6
means almost bedbound.
Okay, so...
So these individuals, 9 females and 6 males, had to travel every month to the center to be analyzed, to be tested, to be examined, to be sampled multiple times. So they were incredibly resilient and incredibly supportive. This study would not be available if these patients and their family would have not provided the support they gave, much more than any funding body. As you can see from the other matrix, the mean age of treatment is 50 years. So it is a disease of the adult is not a disease of the early 20s or 30s, like relapsing remitting MS, with very long disease duration, 23 years average of total disease duration, and 10 years average of conversion from relapsing remitting MS to secondary progressive MS, with stable progression of symptoms in the 12 months before the recruitment. What you are showing now is the way the system works, which is the technology that was established many years ago by Angelo Vescovi, who is the co-senior investigator of the study, which we tested very extensively in animal disease models, in mice, in non-human primates, in different animal models. But basically, you start from a single piece of starting material, which is usually the adult brain. In this case, it's a very small sample of a single human miscarriage fetus, which is then processed and expanded and fully quality controlled in the lab under chemically defined conditions. And under those chemically defined conditions, we have a stable medicinal product which can be produced virtually at the scale that you desire, and which is then analyzed for grow rate, clonal efficiency, which is a way to measure the stemness of the material, multipotency, which is another way to measure whether we are dealing with true stem cells rather than with the progeny of progenitors. It can be expanded almost indefinitely, and then it is fully QC'd prior to injection into the cerebrospinal fluid circulation using stereotaxic guided MRI supervised procedure of injection into one of the lateral ventricles of the brain. What else? You see here from this slide that there is four different doses of cells, starting from 5 millions of cells per individual, single injection, then progressing towards 10, 16, and 24 million of cells.
So and really, the five-fold difference between the lowest to the highest.
Yeah. Yeah. And the choice of the dose of cells was made not by chance. It was made based on two pieces of preclinical and clinical evidence, one of which is, of course, our extensive work in animal disease models, where we have scaled down, actually, the number of cells injected moving from small mice and progressing towards two larger non-human primates, as well as some published clinical work from the very same team on people with ALS, which is another terrible neurological disease. ALS stands for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So there is... It's not a random choice. It is very well supported by additional data.
And I think we're going to touch upon later the fact that results seem to be different based upon the concentration of cells.
Yes, which is why we are excited.
All right. So
because the reason for doing a dose escalating a phase one trial is, first of all, related to the safety and toxicity and tolerability aim of the trial, which implies that you go up with the number of injected cells in order to identify what we call maximum tolerated dose of cells. So the number of injected cells, the minimal number of injected cells at which you start observing adverse events. And we were very lucky not to be able to observe any adverse events at any of the injected doses. So even 24 million of cells did not lead to any major adverse events associated or related, even indirectly, with the transplantation. There were no adverse events associated with the surgery, which might be intended as a very invasive procedure, but instead it's not very invasive. It's a very quick procedure, which is almost a routine in the case of administering chemotherapies in the brain in people with incurable, very aggressive brain cancer. So no adverse events. And this is the study scheme, which implied 3 months of run-in in order to be able to distinguish between individuals with intrinsically active and non-active disease. And then there is the end of the run-in, which also coincides with patient screening. And then there is the surgery and then follow-ups, 1, 3, 6, 9, and 12 months. So it is a very, very short phase one study, only 12 months of follow-up. We are already conducting a longer follow-up of the very same individuals. What's, in my view, can you project again the slide? Because I think an aspect of the trial which is incredibly helpful and informative, which, again, I would like to thank the patients and the families for being that supportive. I don't think I've seen in my career any trial that for the short duration of 12 months provides the team of investigators analyzing the data with as much as 7 serum samples per patient and 5 independent CSF samples. So these patients, but the patient participating in the trial agreed to undergo 5 independent lumbar punctures during the trial and 7 independent blood samplings, which is one of the key aspects of strength of the trial, because when subjecting these biological fluids to very extensive multi-omics, we started observing very interesting biological responses, which were not expected at all out of a phase one trial on people with very advanced disease. You can see here that CSF is mentioned at the start of the run-in, at the end of the run-in, so these 2 samples prior transplantation. Then there is CSF again 1 month post, CSF again 6 months post, CSF again 12 months post. So we have a very nice longitudinal sampling of CSF and serum, which is the biology of the response to the treatment that we thought we would have had the opportunity to study even in a phase one proof of concept clinical trial on people with very advanced disease. There were, of course, EDSS, which is, again, clinical assessment, several MRIs, and there was immune suppression. So the immune suppression is not trivial. In my race arguments from peers, but it is a very low-dose immune suppression, combination of very small-dose steroids and tacrolimus for only for 24 weeks, so very small part of the study. But it was kind of inevitable because the immune identity of the starting material is allogeneic as compared to the recipients. So we wanted to make sure that everything was in the right place to avoid any potential risk of rejection of the graft once cells were injected into the cerebrospinal fluid through the circulation. And this is pretty much the study scheme.
Well, hi everyone, Dr. David Perlmutter here. We hope you're enjoying this content, and if you would do so, go ahead and hit the like button. And if you're not already a subscriber to our channel, please consider doing so. We're really grateful to have you as part of our community, so let's get right back to the presentation. So I think that what people want to know then is, how did it work out? And what did you find? I mean, let's talk about the biomarkers, but clinically as well, how well did the intervention work?
Clinically, again, looking at the remit and ambition of a phase one trial, the ambition is demonstrating proof of evidence of feasibility, safety, and tolerability. So let's start from the feasibility. And the feasibility was fully in place because feasibility, when developing an advanced cell therapy for humans, you have to show that you can make it. And we made it. We developed a clinically applicable EMA, which is the European FDA approved advanced cell therapy medicine, a single cell line, which is a non-immortalized human fetal neural stem cell line, which was developed in clinical grade conditions. So it was clinical cGMP certified, and we managed to deliver successfully each of these patients with a cell line in the surgery operating room using, as I said, these stereotaxic guided MRI supported or supervised injection procedure with no adverse events whatsoever.
But you're simply doing an intraventricular injection, correct?
Yeah. But in the brain, yeah. So it was doable. Yeah. It was feasible. the safety, there were no adverse events whatsoever. Not short term, not medium term, not long term adverse events. So it was safe. And the tolerability is the identification of the maximum number of cells at which adverse events start appearing. And as I said at the beginning, not even at 24 million of cells per patient, we ever saw any adverse event. So it was safe, it was feasible, safe, and well tolerated. And then we started looking at what we call secondary outcome measures of the study, which is kind of exploratory outcome measures, including MRI matrix, including changes in the levels of serum biomarkers, and including what you were alluding to, which is sampling and unbiased, unsupervised screening of potential mediators of brain responses into biological fluids. So the MRI showed no increase in disease activity, no increase in the frequency of new gadolinium enhancing lesions, something which is very important. There was stability of major MRI features with a progression of brain atrophy, which is very much in line with the intrinsic rate of brain volume loss that we know for MS. And this is very important because there was another trial, a competing trial, being published by another group in Italy, with a much more heterogeneous cohort of patients recruited, including active and non-active primary and secondary progressive MS, which instead showed a quite unexpected increase in the number of T2-weighted MRI lesions post-transplantation, and 25% of patients participating in the trial also developed gadolinium-enhancing lesions, which now, is a way to measure...
Same type of stem cells, number one and number two, were those patients immunosuppressed?
Macroscopically, yes. Macroscopically, is the same type of stem cells, so brain stem cells. But of course, there is differences when looking at the specifics of the ACT, but macroscopically, in terms of big concept,
okay. Were those the same type of technology? Were they immunosuppressed for the first 24 weeks?
There was much more immune suppression than the one that we provided. More immune suppression. The route of delivery was different, so it was not intracellular ventricular, but it was intrathecal via therapeutic lumbar puncture, still in the cerebrospinal fluid circulation. What was very much different comparing the two studies, and it is a crucial aspect of an innovative trial delivering an innovative medicine, was the quality of the product. So we ended up, like many other cell therapy studies, with at least 80% of viable cells at injection, which is the standard. The other study ended up with 45% viable cells at the time of injection, which might have introduced a bias towards whatever response of the host to poorly viable cells. Nonetheless, 25% of people, patients participating in the trial developed contrast-enhancing lesions, which is a way to measure disease activity, something that we did not observe in our study. Looking at brain volumes and brain volume changes, we found a direct an inverse correlation with the number of cells. So the more the cells, the least reduction of parenchymal brain volumes, which, however, in the absence of a control study, a control group, so a group receiving only placebo, it's difficult to interpret in full. It might be a way to measure
small number of participants.
It might be pseudoatrophy. Pseudoatrophy is a very complex concept in neuroradiology, which is a paradoxical response of the total brain volumes to therapies or drugs which put down the immune system. It is very, very frequently observed following autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, and it is usually recovered by 12 months. So we want to be very careful with this pseudoatrophy thing, because it might be very misleading to get to a conclusion in a trial which is not designed to support that statement. And then we ended up with a we started analyzing.
Yeah. No, the two findings thus far that you have categorized for us or described, that we did not see an increase over time of these contrast-enhancing MRI lesions, These are considered active lesions. When we do an MRI on a patient with MS, we give contrast gadolinium, which shows, let's say, leakage of fluid that lights up new lesions or lesions that are active, number one. And you also measure brain volume, which tends to decline with time in MS patients as well. And you found a relationship then with higher dosages of your cell count in the injection with lower rates of loss of brain volume. So both of the things that you found are looked upon as being quite favorable.
Yes, but this is a phase one study, so I don't think we can agree on any final statement.
I can say that, though.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
Yeah, okay, we'll admit that.
We have to be very cautious when communicating these findings to lay audience, because there is lots of expectations we were saying at the beginning. So it is something which is very promising and for which we need to run a phase 2 study, because otherwise we will never know what is the impact of these findings in a bigger picture. And then there was the biomarker thing. And we developed a completely agnostic approach. Actually, we went in parallel. We went by candidate, by measuring the very well-known and very well-established neurofilament light chain levels in serum. This is a very well-accepted yet completely unspecific marker of neuronal damage or neurodegeneration. And interestingly enough, we found an increase in neurofilament light chain only 1 month post transplantation, very likely correlated to the invasivity of the transplantation procedure. But then all the other levels from run-in to the end were very stable. So there was no increase in neurofilament light chain. Again, another aspect which is very much in contrast with the other study that I mentioned before, which instead showed a continuous increase in neurofilament light chain levels in serum during the whole length of the study. And then we developed a completely agnostic approach in collaboration with Angelo D'Alessandro, who works at the University of Colorado in the States, who is running with a guru in metabolomics, lipidomics, and proteomics. So basically, we subjected the 5 longitudinal CSF samples per patient and the 7 longitudinal serum sample per patient to untargeted mass spec analysis of proteins, lipids, and metabolites. And the agnostic nature of the approach is also very exciting, because we didn't want to go by candidate. We wanted to measure how the human MS brain at that stage of disease responds, if it does, to the transplantation of live, viable, and potentially therapeutic neurostem cells by comparing time 0 with time 12 months. And interestingly enough, and that's why we are so excited to working together a phase 2 study, what we found was a dose-dependent and time-sustained response in the CSF only. So the serum was very, very messy. There was no correlation. There was no separation between the different samples. It was all around. There was also possibly a confounding effect, at least in the first 24 weeks of the study, of the concomitant immune suppression. So very difficult to clean and to interpret and to infer anything out of the serum data. The CSF was instead very clean, and the data belonging to each group of patients transplanted with different number of cells were very separated from each other. There was a dose correlation, so the more the cells injected, the higher the levels of something that I'm going to describe to you. And it was also sustained over time, so increasing every month of the trial up to 12 months post-transplantation. And the candidates that we found particularly upregulated were acyl-carnitines and byproduct of fatty acid metabolism, which we don't know yet what it means biologically. It suggests that with something there ongoing, there is a dynamic response of the brain to the single perturbation that we have applied, which is the treatment. And therefore, we are very, very curious to understand when introducing a group of patients injected with the vehicle only, with the placebo, with the dummy medication, what's going to happen? And which is basically what we are trying to put together as a phase two study to be conducted afterwards.
This really speaks to a metabolic underpinning, doesn't it? That with both the acyl-carnitine and the fatty acid metabolism. And it makes you wonder if there's a phenotypic change, for example, in microglia going from the M1 to the M2, rather M2 to M1 phenotype, such that it's now involved in the digestion of myelin. But the upstream issue really ultimately becomes metabolic. And that, you know, certainly might open the door with what you have found, even at this early stage, to more metabolic interventions. You know, the newer drugs are NRF2 activators, and they seem to target metabolism as well as inflammation. So, gosh, this is a very important finding that you've just discovered.
Yeah, we are very, very sensitive to the topic because the part of the lab that you just featured earlier is actively working at the understanding of how cell metabolism controls the transition from different cellular states. We know that we know now, thanks to this new generation single cell analysis, that each cell type in our body is highly heterogeneous, and cells are able to jump from one cellular state to the other. Each cellular state is associated with homeostatic rather than anti-inflammatory, rather than protective, rather than pro-inflammatory functions. We have a specific interest towards microglia and astrocytes, which are the major cells of the brain controlling and driving immune-like reactions. And a previous study from my team, which was published back in 2018, showed metabolic affinity between neurostem cells and macrophages, microglia in general, myeloid cells. And this metabolic affinity or metabolic vicinity or metabolic promiscuity led to a, I think it's the first ever druggable mode of action of a stem cell therapy. In a nutshell, what we found is that cells use nutrients and food and fuels to survive and to survive and to action in different body sites. And what we found is that there is a common metabolite, which is a small molecule that on one side accumulates into macrophages and microglia when they become, as you said, M1-like, which is pro-inflammatory tissue damage mode. In that specific cellular state, their mitochondria go wrong, their TCA cycle gets dysfunctional and disrupted, and macrophages and microglia start accumulating metabolites, one of which is called succinate. And the succinate is also a metabokine, which means that this is a small metabolite that is able to work in the cell, but also to signal via a cognate receptor when it is released extracellularly. Therefore, contributing not only to the self-regulation of the pro-inflammatory state of the macrophage and microglia, but also contributing to the perpetuation of inflammation. And what we found was that neurostem cells are incredibly avid for succinate. So they are incredibly potent scavengers of succinate. And in fact, if you inject neurostem cells into the CSF circulation, you will find a decrease of the levels of succinate, and you will find reduction of the pro-inflammatory activity of macrophages because they will not be able to find enough succinate anymore, and they will not be able to be as inflammatory as they were in the absence of the transplantation cells. So that's why we are so interested now to see in humans, in clinical trials, what happens if we can make a good use of these anti-metabolic abilities of advanced cell therapeutics to reprogram what is bad for tissue damage and disease progression into something which becomes tissue healing.
For our viewers, if you've been able to hang in there with us thus far, you'll realize that we've kind of come full circle. This is the upstream target that you and I talked about at the very, very beginning. Upstream of the demyelinization, upstream of the immunoreactivity, it attempts to answer, or it may answer, why. why is there immune dysregulation? And you know, it may center on this metabolic issue that's changing the phenotype and therefore functionality of astrocytes and microglia and macrophages. So wowzers, more news to come. We don't have a huge amount of time left, but I wanted to I'm having chills. This is such impressive work. But your lab is doing a lot of work in exosomes. And I think that's probably a term many of our viewers have heard. Can you give us just a brief overview of what the exosomes, what they are, and what you think you might be able to discover with respect to using exosomes, either diagnostically or perhaps therapeutically moving forward?
Yeah, the exosome field has been rapidly evolving the last few years. There is increasing interest not only from academics, but also from medium-sized, small-sized, and big-sized companies and industry. Exosomes are tiny organelles which are continuously produced into the cell, which are able to traffic intracellularly. So they are recycling vesicles. They are round-shaped nanoparticles, which can also be secreted from the cell to the outer space. And they are incredibly capable of loading cargos and loading and trafficking potential conveyors of functions. So they are initially used by cells to allow communication between different organelles, from the nucleus to the cytoplasm and vice versa. But once they are secreted, they are able to deliver those cargos and those signals, like nano Amazon, to neighboring cells. So there is an interest around exosome biology, not only to understand how individual cells work, but also especially how cells communicate to each other. And there is two major lines of interest or lines of research in the world, which are tissue non-specific. They can be applied to any condition, any tissue, any biology, which is the understanding of extracellular exosomal signaling as a biomarker of response to physiology and pathology, what we call liquid biopsy. So it's a biopsy of biological fluids out of which a very systematic analysis of circulating exosomes might open new opportunities to develop biomarkers, to understand how disease progresses or how someone responds to medications, what we call also precision medicine-based approaches. Likewise, since because of their intrinsic remarkable ability to traffic and to incorporate multiple cargos, there is lots of interest around exosome biology to as a way to deliver a new generation of therapeutics, a new generation of fully natural, or what we call also naturally occurring, nano vesicles for drug delivery. So on one side, studying exosomes in biological fluids to make predictions of organ, tissue, or metabolic responses to physiology, disease, and treatment. On the other, the understanding of how to make a good use of these intrinsic biological functions of nanovesicles to deliver and to generate fully natural, in principle, compatible and class of drug delivery technologies. So that's what we do with exosomes. And in my lab, we started studying the exosome because of the paradox of not finding so many remyelinating neural stem cells in vivo and starting suspecting that stem cells could work after transplantation by non-canonical mode of actions, one of which might be the release of instructions to neighboring cells in order to instruct pro-tissue healing modalities, which can be also delivered via exosomes. And that's why we started studying how cells communicate each other using exosomes.
Let me, I want to ask a question because there's a concept, a topic, an area of research that you may not be involved in, but you may be aware of. It's senolytic therapy as it relates to neurodegenerative conditions. Are you involved in that at all, or do you have collaborators or colleagues that are exploring perhaps the use of a stem cell therapy along with a senolytic protocol that might add better benefit?
I'm not involved directly in the application of senolytics, but I am very much involved in the understanding of how cellular senescence and biological aging impacts on disease trajectories. And this is a project that we started a few years ago just by chance, because a very talented postdoc from the States wanted to join my lab, and she had started trying to model MS in a dish using iPSC technology, induced pluripotent stem cell technology. And I was very, very, very skeptical because of the sporadic nature of MS. This is not a monogenic disease. It's very we don't have a phenotype. It's difficult to model MS in a dish. And this postdoc came to Cambridge from U Connecticut with a paper which had been published in a very prestigious journal, where she was able to show that there is an accelerated cellular senescence phenotype in neural stem cells from people with MS. And then we started deep diving the thing, and I'm very happy. I'm very excited to say that she was right. The phenotype is there. And therefore, I think we have to take into very, very careful consideration not only disease-associated mechanisms of progression, but also the confounding effect of physiological aging on a background of disease, which I think is a very common feature of multiple tissue-specific diseases. And that's where part of my lab is going now, to understand mechanisms of senescence, the impact of senescence in disease trajectory, starting from disease modeling approaches using patient-specific tools and technologies towards animal disease models, and ideally also clinical trials. There is a very popular medication, which is very popular in the States, is becoming more popular in Europe, and which we are testing now in a very, very popular phase 3 study in people with progressive MS. And the drug, I guess you know already what I'm talking about, is the very famous, very cheap anti-diabetic medication metformin, which is a very dirty medication from a mechanistic perspective, but which is also a very potent non-specific inhibitor of mitochondrial activity, which is also a rejuvenating factor because it's also able to act on transcription factors and the identity of the cell. And it is becoming more popular because of its intrinsic ability to have an impact on the epigenetics of the cells, leading to rejuvenation of cells. So there is, and that's one approach. The senolytic that you were saying is much more radical, which is becoming to be more accepted in cancer. I'm not sure in neuroimmunology or in conditions which are not life-threatening as cancer, whether there is still a consensus, but it is something to consider, possibly in combination with DMTs, which are targeting major pathobiological pathways. Yes.
Well, they're just published several weeks ago an interventional trial in moderate stage Alzheimer's patients based on this whole senolytic idea using quercetin and dasatinib. And the results did not show any significant change in the trajectory of cognitive decline. But, you know, we live in a world of focusing on monotherapy for reasons we could discuss at another time. And it just seems to me that if we can come at these neurodegenerative conditions from multiple approaches, that we might have a better shot at turning them around. I think that, when we look at then mechanistically, what is quercetin doing? I mean, it acts in many ways similar to metformin by targeting AMP kinase, by actually targeting mitochondrial function as well, downregulating complex 1, et cetera. So more to come, but let me just say that I'm really honored to speak with you today, and just totally thrilled with what you're doing. And man, oh man, you know, there's so much craziness going on in the world right now, and to see somebody like you and all the people in your laboratory so dedicated to helping people get through these issues, I'm very touched by it, and again, very grateful that you spent your time with us today.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, we will talk soon. Bye-bye. Wow. I did tell you this was going to be in the weeds, and it was. But, you know, the bottom line is that the intervention, which is using the stem cells as he described, was able to demonstrate a virtual cessation of new lesions related to MS by using gadolinium-enhanced MRI, and also a cessation of brain atrophy or a reduction of the rate of development of brain atrophy, depending on the concentration of the cells that were administered. Really exciting findings and really exceptional work, that's for sure. So excited that these types of research projects are underway around the world, because we surely need them. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter here on The Empowered Neurologist, and we will be back soon. Bye for now.